It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what is the cost of gun violence in Wisconsin? An investigative reporter examined one case in Milwaukee to find out.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Oshinsky.
The state budget is still working its way through the Joint Finance Committee. We'll look at one of the items that's holding it up and get maybe a timeline for when it'll get back on the road.
Another item that made news this week was the state assembly passing a bill that would eliminate the waiting period for handgun purchases in Wisconsin.
We'll cover those stories and more right now as we're joined by WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Oshinsky. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, and good afternoon and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, a non-budget item got some big news this week. Rose and fell pretty quickly, the Legislative Audit Bureau.
Right. So this is one of those stories that sort of came out of nowhere, at least. We had some key budget items, obviously, in limbo, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But this I think, was one of the biggest stories, at least to come out of the Capitol. Big Bend Republican Representative David Craig started floating a plan this week that eliminated the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau.
I said Audit Bureau. Fiscal Bureau is what we're talking about.
Yep. Nope. Sorry, the Audit LAB. Bureau. Audit Bureau. Okay. Yep, sorry about that. Audit Bureau, the LAB. And this is the agency, as the name suggests, that sort of serves as something of a watchdog over how tax dollars are spent within agencies.
Now, this is something that often isn't in the headlines, often behind the scenes, but lately it has been.
Right. So, yeah, this is an agency that develops information that lawmakers use to really evaluate how tax dollars are meant or are spent. And one of the reasons why we're talking about it now is because the LAB recently issued a scathing report on WEDIC, the state's job creation agency. So the idea of calling for the elimination of this agency coming so soon after a scathing report on another state agency, it raised some eyebrows.
Mm-hmm. And why did Representative Craig say, let's replace this?
He argues that, inspectors general would be better equipped and more proactive when it comes to sniffing out problems in agencies. His bill, what it essentially does is it eliminates the LAB and then replaces it with inspectors general at individual agencies. So like the DNR would have its own inspector general, the Department of Transportation, and that they would do the auditing that the LAB currently does.
Now, with any legislation like this, to advance, generally it's going to need support of legislative leaders who put it on committee agendas, get this thing through. What have we heard from them on this proposal?
Right. So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, whose blessing you would definitely want, is against it. In fact, he says he'd never support a bill that eliminates the LAB. He says the agency does a fantastic job.
So this got a quick angry response from some and a no thanks response from a key Republican leader here.
Yeah, so I think at least in the short term, I don't think it's going anywhere. But it certainly came out of the blue, and it was a proposal that affected an agency that has been very much part of the news recently.
Okay, so the big news for weeks now, aside from that, has been the state budget. Every week we're hearing a little bit more about what's getting passed, what's getting knocked out of the governor's budget proposal. Slowed down now, it seems like.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this because it's really unusual in a way. The governor and Republican leaders in the state legislature are at a bit of an impasse over the issue of transportation funding. And I mention it because it's so rare to have members of the same party really at odds in this way over a big budget item like transportation.
Yeah, in years past, many years past, if the budget takes a long time, if there are debates, it's because there's divided government.
Exactly.
So the Republicans in the legislature versus a Democratic governor or vice versa, and that's what stalls things. Now it's disagreement within the party.
Exactly. And I think it makes it unusual and may, at the end of the day, maybe affect the timeline a little bit as far as, how this budget is going to proceed.
So what's the roadblock, over transportation funding? No, I'm sorry, I'll stop.
Well played, Rob. Governor Walker wants to borrow $1.3 billion to pay for road projects. Fiscal hawks, of which there are many currently at the Capitol, do not want to see that happen. They don't want to see the state bonding in order to pay for roads. A proposal has been put forward to raise some fees, not taxes, but raise some like user fees and fees associated with buying cars to pay for these repairs. Governor Walker has said he won't sign any budget that includes a fee increase.
So to pass a budget, I guess it's got to include something about transportation. So what's the state of the art right now?
Well, it looks like at this point the decision may be to do nothing.
So not borrow, not raise fees.
Right, or if there is borrowing, to borrow far less. What it will also mean is potentially, and again, I use the word potentially because these negotiations are ongoing, it could mean that specific road projects may actually be delayed. You know, road projects that were scheduled to take place or start this year, they may not happen. In order to save that money.
So what are some of the projects that might be put off because of this?
The Stillwater Bridge to Minnesota, Highway 441 in Green Bay, the I-90 expansion near Janesville, the I-94 corridor between Milwaukee and Chicago, and maybe even the zoo interchange in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the stalled items. And I guess the other one, and we can talk about this probably in future weeks, is the Bucks Arena, right? That's another one of those that's not hammered out yet.
Right. There has been and continues to be disagreement over, you know, who's going to pick up the tab for this arena. How much is the city going to pick up? How much is the county going to pick up? How much is the state going to pick up? And that's still a matter of some debate right now.
Talking to news guy Noah Ovshinsky about the latest news in Wisconsin politics. Now, something that did advance, new changes to Wisconsin's gun legislation.
Right. So gun owners and potential gun owners, the process of buying a handgun for them could go much quicker soon. A bill that eliminates the current 48-hour waiting period for buying a handgun cleared the assembly this week and now is on the way to Governor Walker's desk. Supporters say basically advances in technology make this waiting period obsolete because background checks now can, you know, take a matter of minutes. Critics say the change will increase gun violence. They argue the 48 hours have sort of served as a cooling off period of sorts for people who may be buying a firearm while angry, you know, at a spouse or partner.
All right. This one, as you said, headed to the governor's desk. No expectation that he would not sign this.
I think this is well on its way to becoming law.
And another, before we move on from firearms, another gun-related bill passed this week.
It did, and I think it's also worth noting that it passed with bipartisan support, and it's rare these days. And what this bill does is it allows off-duty or retired police officers to carry concealed guns on school property.
And then a controversial item, we've talked about it a fair amount here on the show, ban on abortions, most abortions, non-emergency abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
Right. And so this is one of the more controversial bills that is currently flying really through the legislature. Earlier this week, the Senate passed a bill that bans abortions after 20 weeks. Supporters say the practice shouldn't be allowed because fetuses at that stage of development can feel pain. Democrats and much of the science suggests that that is not the case. Democrats argue they are intruding in on what should be a woman's decision.
And we've heard from a sponsor of the bill and a Democratic critic of the bill, both here on the show. There are more Republicans. They seem to support this thing. What happens now?
The bill goes on to the Assembly. If it's passed there, then to Governor Walker's desk. He says he will sign it. It remains to be seen what will actually happen in the Assembly. Speaker Robin Voss says he's not sure when it will come up for a vote. It could happen this month. It could happen in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the budget. I know some people have criticized this going into fast track, say, let's do the budget, then let's do other things. I didn't know that there was thought it could go till fall.
Yeah, Voss says it could happen this month or wait.
Mm-hmm. So that may not be the end of the story. Like a lot of legislation, it goes to the legislature, then to the governor.
And then lawyers
then
start billing hours.
Right. So there's the courts to think about here.
Right. So I think there's a good chance this could be challenged in court. If it is, it may face an uphill battle, at least in the lower court system. The Supreme Court has said states can only restrict abortions involving fetuses that can exist outside of the womb, which means around 24 weeks. The bill we're talking about here, it would ban them after 20 weeks. So it's not clear if this bill in its current form would pass muster with the Supreme Court.
So this is one we could be talking about a long time if it starts making its way through the legal system.
Yeah, to be continued.
All right. Noah, thanks as always for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Add up the costs to Wisconsin emergency rooms for gun-related injuries and deaths. The total comes to approximately $20 million, according to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. That's just one of the costs to consider in trying to put an economic price tag on gun violence in the state.
Investigative reporter Kate Golden says, all told, gun violence exacts enormous costs that experts are only beginning to tally.
Kate Golden joins us now. She's a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Kate, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there.
So tell us about the process of trying to put an economic price tag in addition to the human cost of gun violence here in the state.
Well, it's kind of a mess because there's so many costs. If you think about when a shooting happens, there's all this immediate stuff that happens. There's police swirling around trying to figure out who did what, and there's all of these these costs on the criminal justice side, and those extend if someone's found. You know, the prosecution, if someone eventually goes to prison, they may spend years in prison because of a shooting. There are all of those costs. And then there are the costs on the side of the victim. So what actually happened? There's the cost of the actual human life that was lost, which is really hard to measure. And then there are these long-term costs down the road. Of course, there are all these medical costs, but then there's all this really intangible stuff, like how do you put a number on people being afraid to go into a neighborhood, and that's where it gets really dicey.
So why did you decide to tackle this project of trying to calculate, to put a dollar price tag on gun violence?
I think it's because when you look at homicides in Wisconsin, they're so disproportionately concentrated in Milwaukee. So what we're looking at is a situation with, there was something over 100 gun homicides in Wisconsin last year. Most of them are in Milwaukee. Most of them are young, black, poor males. And, you know, it's easy to think about this as just black-on-black problem. But the truth is that when you start talking to economists, it becomes really clear that we are all paying for this. You know, you may have, you know, people may see it as their problem, you know, outside inner Milwaukee. And what one thing that we wanted to do is kind of show how this is actually a burden that's borne by the community as a whole.
So take us through, I think you were looking at a particular case in Milwaukee and trying to walk through the steps of and the costs at each stage. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so we've just really started to do this, and I'm doing this in collaboration with Ashley Luthern at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So the way we're going to break this up is kind of take a look at what economists have done overall, like the big picture costs, and then look at this one case. And she's going to take a look at the prosecutorial side, what kinds of criminal justice side costs were incurred. So Ashley, who's a crime reporter at the Journal Sentinel, she, for instance, can talk about how, you know, when in the first 48 hours of after a homicide in Milwaukee, there's always a couple of detectives are constantly passing off information to each other. That's a, you know, it's an extraordinarily expensive sort of thing to be doing to get to the, you know, to find who is responsible. But I've been talking to victims. So, you know, when you talk to people, they remember, you know, the hospital costs, and that's usually what people think about. But I was talking to a woman whose son was involved in a shooting, and, you know, he lived, but he saw another kid being killed. And he, since then, has had all of this trouble in school. He's had, like, behavior problems. They both had a lot of therapy. Those costs add up. She, you know, every time he has a behavior problem, she has to leave work and go deal with him at her school. They're like, and, you know, they don't feel safe in the neighborhood as well. So even years after, like many years after this one incident, it's had all these long-term effects on their lives and the lives of those people around them.
So when you've chased out these threads and you're done with it, are you hoping to come up with a ballpark number for what it costs the state of Wisconsin in a year for gun violence? Is that what your ultimate goal is here?
People have done this here and there. And, you know, I think that what we can, you know, the best we can do is to be sort of imprecisely accurate about it. because you wouldn't want to be too precise about it, just because some of these costs, very poorly studied, like, you know, this cost of anxiety and stuff like that. I think we will probably be able to put an at least number on some of the costs, and that's probably the best we can do for some of it.
Talking to Kate Golden with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, she and another reporter are trying to figure out what Wisconsin pays, the cost to the state are for gun violence. Now, let's start teasing out some of the particular costs. You mentioned trying to put a value on a human life. And,
yeah.
And on one hand, you think, okay, that's an infinite, it's non-measurable, you can't put a dollar price tag on that. But insurance companies and economists certainly do exactly that. So what kind of numbers do we see when it comes to what a human life is worth?
Yeah, you kind of have to put a dollar value on it in some circumstances, like in civil lawsuits or insurance settlements and things like that. So the number that economists, there's sort of a range of numbers, and they go somewhere between $5 and $9 million. And you know, it's a tough thing to do. So, but that is by far so Mother Jones, the magazine, recently did a nationwide analysis of some of these costs, and they found, just as I've found talking to experts, that is by far the biggest cost that we're talking about.
And then other costs would be the person who is killed in gun violence and the perpetrators in jail are people who aren't making money, they're not adding to the general economy as a whole. Is that something you're factoring in?
Yeah, so there's all of these opportunity costs that are lost when people lose wages and things like that. But there are also these costs, you know, you can sort of think about it in two ways. Like, how much did we actually spend? How much did the homicides that happened cost us in a real way? Like, how much did they cost us in hospital charges? How much did they cost us in terms of police costs or increased security at schools and things like that? There, you know, those are finite numbers at some point. But you can also look at it as a sort of forward-looking problem in terms of, like, people modify their behavior to avoid incurring, you know, to avoid becoming victims of violence. And those are, you know, people make choices all the time. Like, am I going to go downtown to the opera house to, like, you know, see a show or, you know, or not? How worried am I? And it's sort of the same kind of calculation that you might make if you're trying to buy a house and you have to, like, decide how much is that great view worth. So in one way, it's very intangible, but ultimately you have to make a real economic choice.
So as you investigate this, are you finding, I don't know who would do this, economists or maybe real estate people who are able to put numbers on the impact of fear on that generated by a homicide, say, or a shooting, that we can put a number on and add it to the tally?
Well, there is one interesting study by the Center for American Progress back in 2012 that looked at six cities, and they tried to estimate how much, if you could reduce the homicide rate by a quarter, what would happen to the real estate values? And Milwaukee happens to be one of the cities they looked at. And what they found is that if you could do that, reduce the homicides by a quarter, you could, over the next year, increase the value of residential real estate by $2 billion and basically double housing prices. So you could, you know, you'd get an expansion of property tax revenues along with that, and you could either use that to cut property taxes or increase community development spending, what, you know, whatever you want to spend that extra money about, and it would save people about $470 a year.
So as I understand it, this isn't just a Pyrrhic quest for a number here. Then the part two kind of is, if we understand the costs of gun violence, then we could start saying, okay, how much is it worth to invest in things that prevent gun violence? Is that what you're hoping that people can do with the numbers you come up with when you're done with this?
In some sense, I just want people to know, to realize that the costs are being borne by all of us. That's just sort of a big conceptual thing. But in some sense, you could also look at how much, you know, the housing estimates are, you know, very real. You could use that to sort of estimate the value of putting more police on, you know, reducing gun violence or something like that, or, you know, finding other ways to prevent gun violence. So if, you know, we talk about things like smart guns. Say it costs like $100 more for a smart gun than a regular one. So you can kind of think about how many deaths need to be prevented for every like 10,000 smart guns that are sold to make the benefits outweigh the cost. And I think that's where these kinds of estimates can be useful in a very broad sense.
We're joining you mid-project right now. Kate, what is the next step? What are you in the midst of as you work toward this overall goal?
Well, I've spent a lot of time talking to economists and people trying to understand how do you think about this problem, you know? What I need to do next is really talk to more people who've really been in the trenches to understand what kinds of costs they've seen so I can understand it in a more intuitive and like visceral kind of way, because that's really, you know, when it gets down to it, where the story is going to be.
I'll look forward to seeing the end results of this this effort. Kate, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kate Golden, reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about her efforts to measure the costs of gun violence here in Wisconsin.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
The Jurassic Park franchise stomped its way to the box office with Jurassic World, another movie about dinosaurs brought back from extinction by scientists and naturally running amok and making cool dinosaur sounds.
There. You see, I told you. You're welcome. Up close and personal with four dinosauruses.
Ankylosaurus. We shouldn't be here, and there's five dinosaurs.
Well, if you sleep easier at night knowing Jurassic Park is just speculative science fiction, our next guest says the science of de-extinction may be a lot closer to reality than you think. Beth Shapiro is with us now. She's an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's also the author of How to Clone a Mammoth. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how would you define the growing field of de-extinction?
Calling it a field is a little bit generous, I think. it's pretty much just an idea that I think has been sweeping the world since the first Jurassic Park movie came out, with the idea, the speculation that one might someday be able to bring dinosaurs back to life. There have been a lot of recent advances in DNA sequencing technologies and in genome editing technologies, and it's been in the news a lot more recently, that have made people think that this actually might be around the corner. I should say right up front, though, that dinosaur cloning is not right around the corner. This remains science fiction and will do so.
There's a reason your book is called How to Clone a Mammoth and not a T-Rex.
Exactly. Although it is, even that is a little bit of a bait and switch. It probably should be called something like the technologies that one might use to go about cloning a mammoth should be technically feasible and ethically and ecologically a good idea, which it probably isn't.
Well, that's catchy.
Well, so over you can see why I went with How to Clone a Mammoth. Yeah.
Definitely, yes. Well, over the decades, we've been promised a lot, jetpacks, flying cars. So is de-extinction someday, possibly, maybe, if we're really lucky thing, or is it a someday soon kind of thing?
Oh, it really depends what you're willing to accept as de-extinction. So if you're a purist and you believe that what you really want in order to say that a mammoth has been brought back to life is something that looks and acts identically to a mammoth and something that genetically is identical to a mammoth, it's probably never going to happen. If, however, you're willing to accept an elephant that is slightly hairy, maybe, and has the capability of living somewhere it's colder than its regular tropical habitat, then maybe that's something that's in our future.
Well, who is doing the cutting-edge work on this today, de-extinction?
Right. So there are several huge misconceptions about de-extinction that I should get right off the bat here to discuss. The first is that there's anyone actually doing it. So there are a few labs that are out there thinking specifically about some of the different species that they might want to see brought back. So there's the closest that we have to really doing this are two labs in Europe. There's a group that's very interested in recreating the auroch, which is the predecessor of all the different species of cattle that are out there. The auroch is the animal that was domesticated and eventually turned into these different cattle breeds. And so what they're trying to do is use selective breeding. So they choose cattle breeds that look like this ancestral auroch, this big, mean cow, and they breed them together, and they select from those offspring those cattle that look more like what the auroch looked like, right? And so they're using this kind of very slow selective breeding process to bring this back to life. There's another group that are working in Spain, and they're interested in bringing the Bucardo back to life. So Bucardo is an ibex, a type of mountain goat that went extinct in the early 21st century, so not very long ago. And before this species went extinct, they captured the last living individual, a female named Celia, and they harvested some cells from one of her ears. And these cells are still alive. They're growing in a culture, or they're frozen in a lab right now. And because they have living cells, they're able to take these and use this cloning technology, the technique that brought us Dolly the sheep in the mid-1990s, to try to create genetic clones of Dolly. But herein lies the big problem with de-extinction, and that is that if something has been extinct for a long time, there are no living cells. No matter how deeply we look in Siberia in the Arctic permafrost, we're never going to find a frozen mammoth mummy where there are actual living cells that we can use for cloning. And that's why we can't clone, using this particular technology, a mammoth.
Well, so to take that Jurassic Park idea, when they cloned the dinosaurs, you get preserved dinosaur blood, you fill in the gaps with frog DNA, you get a dinosaur. You're saying it's not that easy. So what is the most plausible way to begin to get to a mammoth or something resembling a mammoth?
Right. So the technology that is most likely to be used in this situation, it's really similar to technology that people use when they're doing genetic modifications in anything. And it's kind of very simplistically can be described as a cut-and-paste job, if you will. So we have several genome sequences from mammoths that people have extracted DNA that's all broken into short fragments and pieced together painstakingly using a computer to figure out what a mammoth genome sequence would have looked like. And there are also elephant genome sequences. And you can compare these two and then make a list of all the different places where they're different from each other. And maybe these are genes that mammoths have different changes to that make them able to live in the cold or make them hairier or something like that, where elephants look like something else. And then you can use genome editing technology. The most likely technology to be used has actually been in the news a lot recently. It's called CRISPR-Cas9. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
This CRISPR technology? It's something that is found naturally in bacteria and archaea, and it's used by these organisms as a way of finding things that are invading them, pathogens that would invade them. And this, you can imagine that it's kind of like a little robot. It's not. But imagine that it's kind of like a little robot that you can program to go to a specific genome sequence, a specific set of A, C's, G's, and T's, those are the letters that make up DNA, in a row, and find and grab a hold of that exact specific sequence you've programmed it to go to, and then cut it. And it's really powerful. This technology is being developed now for, to cure human genetic diseases, for example, or in the agricultural industry to create a plant that you might be able to grow without needing to use so many different pesticides, etc. So this technology is not being developed to bring mammoths back to life, but we, if we were interested in doing that, would be able to harness this technology for this purpose. So we could take these little robot-like things that are actually naturally occurring and program them to find a gene that we know what it does in an elephant genome, in a cell growing in a dish in a lab, and send it into that DNA inside the cell, and it will find exactly the place in the gene that it wants to cut it in half, and then stick the mammoth version of the gene in its place, which we could also send into the cell with this little robot. So what you would eventually have are a bunch of cells, elephant cells, growing in a dish in a lab that have a little tiny bit of mammoth DNA that's been cut and pasted into them. And in fact, there is a lab at Harvard headed by George Church that's been working on this, and they have so far been able to swap out 14 different genes in elephant cells growing in a dish in the lab.
So is the goal... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, is the goal then to swap in as much, in this case, mammoth DNA as possible so you get less and less of the elephant and more of the mammoth? Is that what makes it more plausible as you go that way?
Yeah, it is. It's more plausible just because this technology exists and because we now have these sequences of mammoth genomes, so we can start to learn what the differences are. Crucially, it's important to keep in mind that an Asian elephant, which is the closest living relative of woolly mammoths, is already 99% identical at the level of their DNA sequence to a mammoth, just like we are 99% identical to chimpanzees. So all we have to do is find that remaining 1%, and in this case it turns into, that translates to something like a million or a million and a half differences that separate an Asian elephant and a mammoth, and swap those out. And that would be if we wanted to create a genome that was 100% identical to a mammoth. But if that's okay, so then we have to step back and say, so why are we doing this? You know, what would the point of bringing a mammoth back to life be? Do we really want to create something that's 100% identical to a mammoth? And if so, is that enough? Is it enough just to have that sequence of A's, G's, and T's that describe a genome of a mammoth? And that's where the challenge of biology kicks in once again. You know, here we have everyone knows identical twins, sets of identical twins, and many of us know sets of identical twins that are in their 80s and 90s who don't even look alike anymore. And that has nothing to do with their genome sequences. Their genomes are identical, but physically and behaviorally and emotionally, they're different people. And the same thing would be true for this animal that had all of this mammoth DNA. What makes us look and act the way we do are our genomes, yes, but also the environments in which we live, the diets we eat, the stresses we encounter. If we had this embryo, and if we could take this cell, first of all, and turn it into an embryo, which we don't know if we can do yet, and if we could implant that embryo in an elephant surrogate host, which we probably can't do, we certainly don't know how to do that yet, and ethically is probably a terrible idea to do because elephants don't fare particularly well in captivity. But if we could do that, that developing embryo would be exposed to elephant pregnancy hormones and an elephant diet. When it was born, it would live in an elephant habitat, eat elephant food. It would even consume a bit of the dung of its mom, like elephants do, to establish that community of microbes that live in its gut. And we are beginning to learn about how important that community of microbes is in making us look and act the way we do. So even if we could make all of those DNA changes, we would still not be able to create something that was 100% mammoth-like, which is part of my point.
So there are a lot of caveats that you're very sensibly putting out there about this whole process and its prospects. And on the other hand, I've read that there is already a would-be Siberian mammoth sort of preserve in Siberia. So why are people so excited about the prospects of a mammoth?
I think people vary in their reasons for being excited about things, right? I mean, some people are excited about the prospects of bringing back a mammoth because they just really want to see a mammoth. Some people are excited about the prospects of bringing back mammoths because they believe that mammoths filled a particular ecological role, that they performed a service in the ecosystem in which they live that has been missing since they disappeared. And in fact, we know that elephants, as the biggest herbivore that's around in the African savanna ecosystem, do perform really fundamental ecological roles that aren't replaced if they disappear. And there's no reason to suspect that the same wouldn't have been true for a mammoth. So if we were to bring mammoths back and put them back in this Siberian landscape, we may be able to reestablish some of this rich grassland that used to exist in Siberia and provide habitat not just for mammoths but for other species that are still alive today but perhaps in danger of becoming extinct because it's so hard for them to find habitat, like saiga antelopes and wild horses, things like that. For other species that one might consider bringing back, there may be other ecologically compelling reasons to think about bringing them back. For me, ultimately, this isn't something that's possible to do right now. We can't bring back something that that is gone, something 100% identical to a species that was gone. But I think that there may actually be powerful uses of this technology as a tool for conserving species that are in danger of going extinct today, not just because hearing crazy stuff like this and going to watch movies like Jurassic Park actually makes more people aware of the problem of extinction and the crisis that is ongoing today, but because it might actually provide a new and technical solution to some of the problems that we're facing. What if we could use this technology, for example, not to bring back species that are gone, but to use DNA sequences, traits that evolution created that were in these species, as a way of providing an adaptive advantage to species that are alive today?
We're talking about the science of de-extinction now with Beth Shapiro. She's an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and she's the author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how all this would work, if it did work. And we want to hear from you if we could bring back an extinct species. Should we? If we should, which ones? Should we bring back a mammoth if we could? How about the passenger pigeon or the dodo, maybe more recently extinct species? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking right now with Beth Shapiro about the science of de-extinction. She's the author of How to Clone a Mammoth and a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
And we want to hear from you. The technology, the science, as we're hearing, isn't quite there, at least not yet. But if we could bring species back from extinction, one or a bunch of them, should we? What species would you like to see walk the earth once again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Cheryl on the line in Green Bay. Hi, Cheryl.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
Well, I think this is fascinating, and I was especially interested in using the bringing Siberian, that woolly mammoth back for reasons to fill an ecological niche, which I had never thought of before. But my question is, if you're trying to reestablish a herd, if you're trying to reestablish a community of these animals based on filling in the blanks in their closest relative DNA, then they're not going to have any genetic diversity. Is there any way to, in this process of inserting mammoth code into Asian elephant DNA, is there any way to vary that in some way so that you can actually have a self-sustaining herd? And since I'm in a car and driving and on a cell phone, I will hang up and listen to my answer on the radio.
All right. Say no more, Cheryl. Thank you for that call. And Beth, what about that genetic diversity question?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Genetic diversity is important. Crucially, if this were to happen, then the elephant themselves, remember 99% of the DNA sequence is already the same between elephants and mammoths, and the elephant will have diversity. And so the population, we would obviously have to change multiple elephants and do this experiment more than once, but the population would have an underlying amount of diversity to start with. Of course, this brings up a huge problem, which is that we would have to do it more than once. And elephant populations and herds are age-structured and sex-structured. So not only would we have to do this very hard, impossible thing once and have elephants living in captivity for a long time, but we would have to do it for decades to create the kind of population that we would want to have before we release them. This is just another challenge and another reason that I think mammoth de-extinction is probably not such a great idea.
And Beth, you're really thoughtful about what questions we need to ask ourselves when it comes to the thought experiment of de-extinction, along with the science experiment aspect of de-extinction. But what kinds of questions should we be thinking about when we consider candidates for this?
I think the most important question is why. You know, every different species will have different technical challenges associated with bringing it back. There will be different ethical challenges and different ecological requirements. And before we get into actually the nitty-gritty of doing it, we really should understand why we want to bring them back and know that there is a place to put them. I mean, many species that are extinct, the habitat that they used to live in is gone. This is probably one compelling reason in favor of mammoths. There still is habitat in Siberia where they could be released. That Sergei Zimov, in particular, you brought him up earlier, has been purchasing around his home in northeastern Siberia, his Pleistocene Park, which is appropriate for today, I believe. But for many species, like the passenger pigeon, the habitat that these guys needed to survive is gone. So even if we could come up with a good answer to why, is there a good ecological reason to bring them back, would there be a place to put them? Have we figured out what it is that made them go extinct in the first place and fixed it? We wouldn't want something to have the dubious honor of being the first species to be de-extincted and then re-extincted. That's a terrible grammatically thing to say.
Interesting questions, though. And then you look at the problem of, well, wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone. There was a movement to bring the grizzly back to California, habitat where it used to live. And in both cases, people freaked out a little bit about this. You can only imagine how they might feel about a woolly mammoth or something like that. So how do we handle the animal-human interface?
Yeah, a lot of the freaking out about wolves and bears is because they're carnivores. And I think one of the reasons people like mammoths is because they don't feel like they're going to get eaten by them, and their livestock aren't going to get eaten by them. So it's a little bit easier to imagine. But again, wolves are a great example of how sometimes restoring a species does really improve the ecological situation and actually help to preserve habitat that then makes other species fare much better than they did in the absence of these animals.
Do you think there is any sort of scientific hubris going on with scientists working on things like this? Is this something that we should be tinkering with to begin with? As if these species went extinct, it's the natural path of evolution on planet Earth. So why bother doing this at all at this point?
Extinction certainly is a natural thing to happen, but the rate of extinction recently is not natural, and it's certainly a consequence of the way that we as people have changed and shaped our world. There are a lot of us. Our populations are growing. We change everything. We change the water quality and the air quality. I think rather than believing that this is just the natural way of things, for us to be terrible, devastating people that are going to take most of the planet for ourselves and dry everything else to extinction, is a pretty awful way to think about people. Perhaps it's also natural for us to use our big brains that allowed us to become so dominant in the first place to do something good and save these species from going extinct.
And if you listen to the scientists who say we're in the Anthropocene era, an era where humans are affecting things and causing these extinctions, is there a case to be made that there's a moral imperative to bring species back that humans have caused to be extinct?
I think we have a moral imperative to save species that are still alive from going extinct. And if bringing some species back or facilitating the adaptation of living species so that they can survive is what it takes to do that, then I think we do have a reason. We do have an imperative to do that. Things that are gone are always going to be gone. And I really think that most of our attention should be focused right now on trying to keep the things that we still have.
And how would this technology, the science as it's being developed, as we wrap up, Beth, how do you see this perhaps helping that cause?
Well, the example that I like to talk about are black-footed ferrets. So black-footed ferrets are nearly extinct. They suffered a very severe population bottleneck recently. In fact, people thought that they were extinct, and then a surviving population was found. And this population had only a few founders, and so there's very little genetic diversity. And now there's a disease that's killing them off that they have no genetic defenses against. What if we could use this technology? We can't do it yet, but we're closer to this than we are to bringing mammoths back. What if we could use this technology to go back in time by looking at the genome sequences of black-footed ferrets that are in museum collections, or the really fantastic frozen zoo at the San Diego Zoo, where they've actually collected specimens from these animals before they died, before this big population crash where they nearly went extinct, and sequence the parts of the genome that provide defenses against disease, and then use this same technology to swap out the part of the genome in the living animals that are all the same with some of this diversity that used to exist in the past. That could potentially provide these animals a fighting chance at survival. This is how I see the future of this technology really being useful in our fight against the current extinction crisis.
That's a great place to leave it. Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Beth Shapiro is an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Santa Cruz, and she's the author of How to Clone a Mammoth.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.